From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Auburn quarterback Cam Newton can pass. Heck, he can run, too. But will the nation's top college football star and the school he represents remain unscathed after allegations that his camp solicited big money to play at Mississippi State? That story is just ahead on Only a Game. Also, Philadelphia sports fans gut their beloved Spectrum. Also, an otherwise modest Texas town builds a $60 million football stadium for school kids.
Texas football is great. You know, everybody follows the kids and supports the kids, and that's the beauty of it right there.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Maybe Cam Newton, the quarterback at Auburn University, will win this year's Heisman Trophy. And maybe he won't even be considered for that distinction. It will depend not only on how Newton and Auburn perform on the field, but upon whether investigations now in progress determine that Newton or his representatives offered his services to Mississippi State University if the price was right. Pete Thamel, who's been covering the story of Cam Newton for the New York Times, joins me now on the phone. Pete, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, happy to be here.
Cam Newton's college football career began at Florida, where he enrolled in January 2007. What were the circumstances under which he left that university two football seasons later?
He left Florida under a cloud of controversy. The reason most assumed and most wrote this offseason and this season about Cam's departure from Florida was because he had got arrested and charged three times with stealing a laptop computer. He and his family, once the season started going well for Auburn University, started to tell people that the reason why he left Florida was because he did not want to sit another season behind Tim Tebow, who had just won the national title and had won the Heisman Trophy his sophomore year, and that he wanted to go elsewhere for playing time.
Well, there have also been allegations that Newton engaged in academic fraud while at Florida. He transferred to Blinn Junior College after that. Why Blinn?
Well, Blinn is actually, if you follow college football recruiting closely, and thankfully for you, you don't, Blinn is a place where a lot of players go. I would say it's a perennial top 10 junior college. It's a place to rehab a transcript. It's a place to go to rehab your reputation. Since he played very little his 2 years at Florida, it was an opportunity to play. So with the academic allegations hanging over him upon his departure from Florida, it was sort of a safe landing place for a year before he could return to a prominent locale.
Mississippi State was among the universities interested in recruiting Cam Newton. According to at least one of the former players there, John Bond, how did that recruiting process proceed?
Bond, who played there in the early 80s, went public about a week ago now and said that he was approached by a former teammate about a specific payment in order to secure Cam Newton's signature on a letter of intent for Mississippi State. Mm-hmm. And that has set off the current firestorm that we're in right now.
Bond is not the only person saying that this, in fact, happened.
Correct. There were developments on Thursday afternoon that Kenny Rogers, who's essentially a recruiter for an agent or a middleman for an agent, Kenny Rogers went on the radio on Thursday in Dallas and said that Cecil Newton Sr., Cameron Newton's father, told him it would take between $100,000 and $180,000 in order for his son to go to Mississippi State.
Also on Thursday, Mississippi State booster Bill Bell told ESPN that Cecil Newton did ask for money. Cam Newton and his father have denied that anyone in the family ever said to assistant coaches at Mississippi State that it would take more than a scholarship to convince Newton to play football there. Is this a matter of choosing whether to take the word of the Newton family or the word of Bond and Bill Bell, who have said Newton was shopped?
it's really just kind of a mess right now, Bill, to be honest with you. It's going to be a tricky issue for the NCAA because certain people involved, like Kenny Rogers, aren't obligated to speak to the NCAA. And also, in Kenny Rogers' interview, he said he has no idea if Auburn paid for him. So they're certainly under a haze of horrible perception right now, but there is no tangible proof that they've done anything wrong.
Let's step back from the controversy that's currently going on for just a minute and tell me, how good is Cam Newton?
Cam Newton is hands down the best player in college football right now. He has had a transcendent season. He's taken an Auburn team that is really a good team, but not a great team, and he has elevated them to an elite team. He can pass. He's the nation's 10th leading rusher overall. Cam Newton is as dynamic a player as college football has seen this generation.
Pete, we're talking about Cam Newton because he's good enough to be considered a Heisman candidate. How often are other lesser players at various universities involved in similar circumstances and we never hear about them because they're not being considered for major awards?
That's a great question. And I think it's more often than, you know, the general public who sits on their couch and flips on ESPN or CBS on a Saturday knows. And it's probably more often than anyone really wants to know. I mean, college sports, Bill, is a $1 billion industry predicated on essentially free labor. Cheating is as much part of the lore of college sports as, you know, the Heisman Trophy or game-winning touchdowns. It's been happening for generations and will continue to happen for generations. So I would characterize it, from having covered college sports for almost 15 years, as very frequent.
If the investigations currently underway determine that Cam Newton was represented by somebody who tried to solicit money in return for his playing football at Mississippi State or anywhere else, what would happen to Cam Newton?
If it's proven that he or his father took money, he would become ineligible and Auburn's season would be flushed. The chances of that happening in the next month are not good. The classic example is obviously Reggie Bush, which took 5 years for them to finally wrap up their investigation. It is the worst possible perfect storm for the NCAA to have basically the next four major events on their calendar under this haze, and that includes the Heisman Trophy, the national title game, the SEC title game, and the Iron Bowl between Auburn and Alabama. There's certainly going to be some late nights in Indianapolis trying to fight their way through it in the next couple weeks.
Pete Thamel is the National College Sports Reporter for the New York Times. Pete, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks for having me.
It's the end of an era in Philadelphia. This week, demolition crews went to work tearing down the Spectrum, the South Philly arena that was home to the 76ers and the Flyers for nearly 30 years. But before the wrecking balls flew, Philly fans had a chance to grab any piece of history that wasn't bolted down, and some that were. If you can carry it, you can keep it, was the motto of last Saturday's event. Reporter Joel Rose hauled back this story.
The Spectrum hasn't hosted a sporting event or concert in over a year, so it wasn't clear what, if anything, was left in the old arena. Still, 1,000 fans lined up outside the Spectrum on a brisk November morning and paid $25 for a chance to find out. Some, like Andy McClave, had been there all night.
I was at the very first game here in 1967. I was at the last game. My father brought me up as a Flyers fan. I hope to grab some memorabilia out of here. Maybe a couple chairs and maybe a sign or two, whatever get my hands on.
McClave was near the front of the line, which started at the big metal gate that leads into the belly of the arena. From there, the line snaked on and on through the parking lot. That's where I found Brandon Frank. He wasn't sure if anything would be left by the time he got inside.
People are coughing up $25 and you don't know if it's going to be awful going in there and you're going to come out with like a pipe or a screw or something.
It's been almost 15 years since the 76ers and Flyers moved across the street to the Wells Fargo Center, a larger, fancier arena. The Spectrum still hosted minor league hockey and the occasional concert, but you could tell that its best days were over.
In its day, it was just an unbelievable building. The seats were great, and, you know, you were close to the action.
Tim Sweeney and his wife Valerie heard about the pre-demolition sale on TV the night before, so they decided to come say goodbye to the Spectrum in person.
And I started remembering all the concerts I've been to here. What did I say? George Harrison, David Bowie, Jethro Tull. A lot of history. A lot of smoke came out of that building, too.
What kind of smoke? I guess I shouldn't ask that question.
Smoke, all kinds of smoke. Oh, man, they used to pass around all kinds of stuff back in the day. Just going in for the last time and seeing it would be cool. So,
especially to see it where the performers and the athletes were down on the floor.
Yeah. One last look.
The gates opened at 9 a.m. Fans at the front of the line poured into the Spectrum. They wasted no time grabbing anything they could lay their hands on. Used skates, pieces of floorboard, hockey sticks, socks and pants, office furniture, and more. Pete and Jen DiDonato had been waiting in the parking lot since 5 in the morning.
It looks like I scored big time.
What is this thing?
It's a practice net.
Practice net.
Yeah.
Cool. Looks like it's about a million years old.
Yeah, it's about a million years old, which makes it memorable to us, I think. I hope.
Most of the fans came from Philadelphia and its suburbs, but a few hailed from farther away. Mike Warlow made the trip from Toronto.
We read it in the paper yesterday in the Toronto Sun. Next thing you know, 9 o'clock, I told the wife, we're packing up and heading to Philly.
Warlow drove through the night with his brother-in-law, Kyle Alves. When I met them, they were wearing matching curly wigs they had discovered in a filing cabinet at the Spectrum. And they were staggering toward the parking lot with a pair of seats they could barely lift.
Yeah, we got about 8 fold-up chairs and the 2 bolted-down seats, and we have a bag full of goods, so we did pretty well.
Can you get this in your car?
Oh, we got a little 4-door Dodge Avenger. Hopefully we can, and some bungee cords. Hopefully that'll do the trick.
Considering how many fans showed up and how many didn't sleep at all the night before, the event went pretty smoothly. There were no fist fights and only a few raised voices. Although it was a good idea to keep a close watch on your pile of stuff.
See, once you take your eye off, it's going to be somebody else going to take it.
Darren Press normally works at the Wells Fargo Center. He came in early to help set up for the event at the Spectrum and stayed to watch fans take the place apart.
People older than me, they had a lot of memories here. That's probably why some of them here and their grandkids and stuff and their children here coming here to get some of it from memories when their father or their mother was here.
That's what brought Christian LeCompte of New Jersey. He was recovering from a torn biceps tendon with his arm in a sling.
Just had surgery 3 weeks ago.
And yet here you are.
Yeah, I should be sitting at home with an ice pack wrapped around my arm.
What brought you out here in spite of your injury?
Just being a huge Sixer and Flyers fan, plus all the events that I came to here with my father. It would be cool to have a couple relics from the place before it comes down. Just remember my old man by.
By 10 o'clock, anything with a tangible connection to the Sixers or Flyers was long gone. Pretty much the only things left to take were a bunch of folding chairs and some nondescript office furniture. I walked through the big metal gate and out into the parking lot where hundreds of people were still waiting in line to get in. For Only a Game, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia. 76ers, Charles Barkley, this Larry Bird.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. On last Friday's edition of Wheel of Fortune, the spinning of the wheel was followed by a contestant guessing the letter L would be included in the mystery phrase. That should have been just the beginning of the round, but Caitlin Burke, looking at that L, an apostrophe, and 26 blank spaces, said she knew the phrase. Okay, said host Pat Sajak, though he was plainly skeptical. The audience chortled. How could this be? I've got a good feeling about this, said Caitlin Burke, and that was indeed the phrase. How'd she do it? Ms. Burke shrugged and said, I had a good feeling about her. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the case for objectivity in soccer reporting.
Ha!
But first, tomorrow the Phoenix International Raceway will host NASCAR's Cobalt Tools 500, the next to last race of the season. Joining me now to discuss the three-driver photo finish for the Sprint Cup is Sports Illustrated's Brant James. Brant, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
Very well, and you're very welcome. Denny Hamlin won two of the last three races, including the AAA Texas 500 last weekend, to take the lead in the chase. Hamlin was NASCAR's 2006 Sprint Cup Rookie of the Year. How dominant has he been this season?
He has been very good. I mean, he has overcome a lot of obstacles. One of the first and major obstacles was the expectation that he would be the man that would challenge Jimmy Johnson. Carl Edwards had that last year. The previous season, he'd won nine races, won the last race of the year, and he was instantly anointed the challenger. He was going to be the man to either bring down Jimmy Johnson or be his top threat. Had a total disaster season last year, didn't win a race, got nowhere close. So Denny, you know, inherited that mantle this year, embraced it. You have to. What else are you going to do? You can't run from it. He also blew out his knee playing pickup basketball in the middle of the year, which may not sound like a big deal for someone who, you know, sits on their butt and drives a car for a living, but as someone who's had that surgery, and I sit on my butt a lot, it still hurts. It's an aggravation and shifting and driving that car. But, you know, handled it well. Came into the chase as the top seed with the most wins and sort of plotted out which races were going to be where he would make a stand because of past performance. And he's pretty much followed his script at this point to put him where he is.
Jimmy Johnson has six wins this season and trails Hamlin by 33 points, and Kevin Harvick is 59 back of the leader. What will Johnson and Harvick need to do in order to pass Hamlin in the final 2 weeks?
I think Jimmy Johnson just has to be himself. He's tremendous at Phoenix. He's won four of the last six there. I mean, he's always very good there. It's always been the spot where Jimmy completely demoralizes the rest of the field and turns the final race of the season at Homestead into basically a series of victory laps. I expect him to be very strong there. Kevin Harvick has won twice at Phoenix, but he hasn't done it for 4 years. But, you know, this guy, he's a street fighter type. You know, for the last several weeks, he's had cars that have been run into. He's run into other things. He screamed at his crew chief over the radio about pit calls. He's been complaining, and then he always ends up in the top five. He's right where he needs to be.
Denny Hamlin's win at the Texas Motor Speedway last weekend was somewhat overshadowed by a brawl between Jeff Gordon and Jeff Burton after a disagreement about position. The two drivers ended up on the wall. Later, Burton said, and I'm quoting now, "I knew he wasn't coming over to shake my hand." Tell us what happened and who was really at fault.
Well, Jeff Burton, he took the blame for it. It was a bizarre situation under caution. It's strange. I mean, this, you know, you apply this to geopolitics. This was Sweden and Switzerland going at it. You know, Jeff Burton, just one of the real pros, the veteran, the sage of the garage. The media runs this to this guy whenever there's a big issue. He's reasoned. And Jeff Gordon, not really a brawler. You know, he's a guy out there trying to win races, and he often squawks on the radio and lets his feelings be known, but he's not a guy that gets into fights. So seeing these two go at it, it's not really a fight, sort of a, you know, an aggressive hug that lasted for a couple of seconds. But it may be a little bit of a rumba, but it didn't last very long, and you know, the emotions were played out in front of a cheering set of grandstands and a national television audience with its, you know, mouth agape, and then it was mostly over. There's some jawing by Gordon, blowing off steam afterwards, but it was amazing to see. It's certainly another sublime moment in a very strange week last week.
Well, the hug or the rumba or whatever you want to call it was not the only wild happening at last week's race. There was the case of the pit crew swap, but also a $25,000 bird that flew into Kyle Busch's cockpit. Have I got that latter story right?
Yes, absolutely. Someone cleverly said they were surprised that the fine wasn't reduced to single digits. Get it? That wasn't mine. But, Kyle Busch showed his lack of regard for a NASCAR official and the lack of regard for a speeding penalty that had been levied against him, and he stuck his middle finger out the window for all to see, including that camera 2 feet away from him in the car, and that image was
broadcast all over the world and all over those NASCAR monitors. You know, the new sort of have at it boys edict that they've allowed the drivers to sort of play out and have, you know, altercations such as Burton and Gordon with nothing else. No, there were no punishments against them, but NASCAR does not put up with insubordination, and the middle finger toward an official on pit road was clearly within that realm, and he got slammed for it.
Brent, I can't wave the checkered flag on this interview, so to speak, until I put you on the spot. Denny Hamlin, Jimmy Johnson, or Kevin Harvick? It's a tight race. Who wins the Cup?
I said it in January, and I'll stay with it, not because I'm just being stubborn, but I think Jimmy Johnson's going to win another one. He's been there. He's done that. He has four under his belt. I don't think that means he would want a fifth any less. He knows what it takes, and I think he's sufficiently motivated with the events of last week, and I think he's going to do it.
Brant James covers NASCAR for Sports Illustrated. Brant, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome. It's always fun.
Rotated tires, balance line, high stock pain, money getting by. She looks like she's flying when she's sitting at a stop. Your gross straight getting garbage. There's nothing next to mine. This ain't no Sunday drive. Got the tag.
East is east, and west is west, except in Major League Soccer, where the Eastern Conference Championship game will pit the Colorado Rapids against the San Jose Earthquakes, the team that eliminated the New York Red Bulls and headliner Thierry Henry from the postseason last Thursday night. The game to determine whether the Rapids or the Earthquakes will play for the MLS Cup next Sunday will occur tonight in Colorado. Of David Beckham's role in leading the LA Galaxy to the Western Conference Championship game, his coach Bruce Arena said Beckham's set pieces were terrific. So maybe Mr. Beckham is worth all those millions after all. The Galaxy must beat FC Dallas to advance to the MLS Cup. Those two teams will meet tomorrow night in Los Angeles. Of the game most of the rest of the world calls football, John Doyle has said, "I don't believe in God, but I do believe in the soul of soccer." John Doyle is the author of The World is a Ball, subtitled The Joy, Madness, and Meaning of Soccer. He arrived at that conclusion about the game's soul after almost a decade of traveling the world to witness some of the game's most significant competitions, three World Cups and three European Championships between 2002 and 2010. John Doyle joins me now from the CBC in Toronto. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi there, Bill. Nice to be here.
The World Cup is soccer's most grand showcase, and at the 2006 World Cup in Germany, you write that you felt you were, I'm quoting now, part of a vast, living, and endlessly moving phenomenon. Of course, you acknowledge that you were jet-lagged and exhausted, so was this living, moving phenomenon a hallucination, or was there something more to it than that?
No, Bill, I don't think it's a hallucination. There are few more spectacular experiences, I think, than actually being in the host country of a World Cup while the tournament is unfolding, because there is the vast number of fans from the various countries appearing at the World Cup who go to the host country, and then they float from city to city, often, as in the case of Germany, and floating in a sort of sea of beer. But they're enjoying themselves. They're supporting their country, but also acknowledging that everybody else is there to appreciate and support soccer played at its highest level. There is an amazing sense of brotherhood, and it is the world's best party.
There's an old rule regarding sports writers that goes no cheering in the press box, and that rule really doesn't seem to apply at major soccer tournaments. Which country's writers seem to you the most unapologetic fans?
The Brazilians. I have never seen a press corps like the Brazilian press corps that follows the team at the World Cup. If you go into the press area at a stadium where Brazil is playing, many of the reporters from print, from television and radio are wearing Brazil shirts. They stand up and cheer, not just when there's a goal, but when there's a lovely move by the Brazilian players. The dynamic in part, I think, is generated by the feeling in the country that everyone is part of the team. And that, I think, explains why some of the press corps will lose any sense of objectivity in those situations.
Spain beat Holland in the 2010 World Cup final, and you seem to feel that was not only very good for Spain, but very good for soccer as well. How so?
The triumph of Spain in the final game was really the triumph of grace and beauty over violence and coercion. I mean, the Spanish style of endless passing, that tic-tac-toe game, it's a very elegant kind of self-restraint. Holland really had no tactic that could respond to that style, so they simply opted for coercion, for violence, for toughness, and it didn't work. It was, I think, hugely symbolic for the idea of soccer as the beautiful game that Spain won in the end by sticking with that combination of self-restraint and elegance.
I'd like you to read from your description of a World Cup qualifier between Holland and Ireland in 2002, a game that you didn't even attend. It's the second paragraph on page 38.
Okay. The game that mattered was the second game against Holland, played in Dublin. I watched it in a crowded bar in the Toronto suburbs. Roy Keane was everywhere in the game, launching sliding tackles against the fleet-footed Dutch forwards, controlling the pace and owning the space around him. A win would almost guarantee Ireland's qualification for this World Cup. Ireland won 1-0, playing with a tenacity and confidence that was unnerving to watch at a distance. When the game ended, we all looked at each other in that crowded Irish bar and beamed. Two elderly men stood up, embraced and wept. The team had again fulfilled the needs of the country and its vast diaspora.
Did you feel any hesitation at attributing to a soccer game the potential to fulfill the needs of a country?
No, I felt no hesitation at all, actually, Bill. I think one of the things going on in my book is the importance of the national team for your home country if you're an immigrant. If you're from a small country somewhere, you've moved to another country like the U.S. or to Canada, how much it can mean to follow the trials and tribulations of your home country's team as it tries to make it to the World Cup or another big championship and then be at the World Cup. And that emotional connection that exists between the immigrant, the home country, through the team, and how the team can, in fact, define the country, not just for the country itself, but for that vast diaspora around the world.
John, The World is a Ball is filled with ambitious conclusions regarding soccer. Some of them are yours, and some of them you cull from other writers and poets and philosophers. But at the end of the book, you seem to me determined to boil it all down to a single sentence. You write, "The game brings joy and kills it." Does that seem to you somehow truer of soccer than any other game?
I think it is, Bill, yes. It's a game that can bring extraordinary joy. There are a few things more pleasurable than being in a large soccer stadium that is filled with 60, 70, 80, 85,000 people experiencing a game. And at the same time, because the game is not perfect and because mistakes are made often by a referee or a linesman, then it can bring heartbreak. It's about society, not just about individuals who are united in the joy and the pleasure of seeing their team at a World Cup or in another large tournament, and then realize that this party isn't going to last forever. It could go badly.
John Doyle is the author of The World is a Ball, subtitled The Joy, Madness, and Meaning of Soccer, published by Rodale. He joined me from the CBC in Toronto. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. My pleasure.
You're listening to Only a Game. Earlier this year, we reported on a New Hampshire man who's attempting to make 1 million free throws to raise money to help U.S. military veterans and their families. Only a Game's Doug Tribou has an update.
Dave Cummings started shooting foul shots on Veterans Day 2009. When we aired our original story in January, Cummings had recently made his 100,000th shot. The Epsom, New Hampshire resident is planning to make number 1 million on Veterans Day 2011. That's an average of about 1,370 foul shots a day for 2 years. On Thursday, Veterans Day, Cummings shot free throws aboard the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum, a retired aircraft carrier in New York City. 98. After knocking down 100 shots, Cummings brought his total to 500,000. The husband and father of three says after shooting every day for a year, he's still excited about the second half of the project.
It feels like we did it once and we can do it again. I think that my family is more committed to it, if anything. To hear from veterans and families of veterans and to hear from Americans all over the country who are just interested in supporting this cause and therefore supporting veterans. It's been incredibly exciting, and if anything, I'm more recharged than ever.
Cummings calls his effort Hoops for Heroes, and he's also attempting to raise $1 million to support the Intrepid Fallen Heroes Fund. The fund's most recent project was constructing a $60 million medical facility in Bethesda, Maryland, for servicemen and women suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. Fund Executive Vice President David Winters says TBI is still something of a mystery to doctors.
So we're researching the best ways to find, diagnose, and treat traumatic brain injury so that our men and women who are serving now, who are injured, won't have a continuing injury that affects them days, months, years down the road.
Cummings presented the Intrepid Fallen Heroes Fund with a check for $10,000 Thursday, bringing his fundraising total to just under $28,000. Cummings is planning to increase his public shooting appearances in the coming year and says he believes as the shot total gets larger, the fundraising will catch up. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
To hear Doug's original story about Hoops for Heroes and see photos of Dave Cummings, visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At nuance.com. This is NPR.
Riding a bicycle is good for you in many ways. It's dandy aerobic exercise, of course, and bike riding gets you out into the fresh air where you're likely to encounter all sorts of people. However, riding a bicycle did not prove to be an effective way for Christopher Todd Mayer to escape after he'd robbed the Wells Fargo Bank in Anchorage one day in May of $1,731. This was because shortly after he'd saddled up, Mr. Mayer literally ran into the sort of people who ride around in a police car. In fact, he ran into the police car itself, slid across the roof of same, and was captured shortly thereafter. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the best not-so-little high school football stadium in Texas. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The controversy about whether Auburn quarterback Cam Newton's father told colleges that his son wanted to be paid for his services is either a big story or an empty charge or something in between. What's your reading of this?
Well, it's hard to say since all of the allegations are coming from representatives of one kind or another of a school to which he did not go, namely Mississippi State. Now, if you want to really go through the looking glass on the way college football operates, you can say to yourself, well, last year Dez Bryant got in a lot of trouble as a wide receiver at Oklahoma State. Oklahoma State benched him until they found out what was going on so they wouldn't get in trouble. Cam Newton's still playing for Auburn. So that leads me to believe, through this looking glass world of college football, that Auburn either thinks there's nothing to this or they think they've got a decent alibi.
I hope fans of the college game in Ann Arbor last weekend were ready for a lot more than some football. Charlie, Michigan beat Illinois 67-65 in the highest scoring game in the history of Michigan football. Did you tune in for any of the three overtimes?
No, I didn't, because I hate the overtime rule in college football. All the people that complain about the way the NFL does it, where if you win the coin flip, all you have to do is drive, you know, 40 yards or whatever and kick a field goal. This is worse. This is flag football. This is something out of a truly bad schoolyard. And no, I'm not impressed at all. That, you know, although I'm willing to bet that one or both of the basketball teams representing that school will have games this year where they don't score as much as the football team did.
This week's NFL games, we'll see headliner quarterbacks facing off against each other. Former teammates Michael Vick against Donovan McNabb, ex-Heisman winners Sam Bradford against Troy Smith, and perhaps most importantly, Tom Brady against Ben Roethlisberger. Got any picks in those?
Well, I don't know about the other two, but I think the Pittsburgh-New England game, at which I will be in attendance, is probably the game of the weekend. Tom Brady's coming off one of the worst games he's ever had against the Cleveland Browns. Pittsburgh is ready to make a statement, and frankly, those are the two best quarterbacks of the six you mentioned.
Jim McMahon, who quarterbacked the Chicago Bears team that won Super Bowl XX, said at a team reunion this week that he'd been having serious memory problems. McMahon is only 51 years old. Is it your sense that current players are paying any attention to stories like this?
No, I think they are, and I think they're more to the point, I think their agents are, if their agents are doing the proper job. But this, again, this is somebody who will be victimized by the fact that the NFL didn't step into the 21st century in terms of what head injuries are until well into the 21st century.
Ndamukong Suh of the Detroit Lions could have set a record for biggest guy ever to kick an extra point last weekend. What was he doing in that position, and what went wrong?
Well, first of all, let's get the football history straight here. Back in the fat tackle slash kicker days, back in the Lou Groza, Lou Michaels days, there were a lot of really big guys who could place kick. It was only when the soccer-style kickers came in and people started to specialize a little bit more did we get the smaller guys. Ndamukong Suh looks exactly like a lot of the place kickers you'll see back in the old NFL films. That being said, both Detroit and the New England Patriots are missing their prime field goal kicker, so the redoubtable House of Spears stepped up and just barely missed. He hit the upright.
The Lakers lost their first game of the season on Thursday night thanks to Carmelo Anthony and the Denver Nuggets, but L.A. coach Phil Jackson says it'll be the Heat and not the Lakers who have the chance to win 70 games this year. Do you think Coach Jackson has actually watched a Heat game this season?
I think he's watched the Lakers and decided they needed someone to light a fire under their keister after their devastating first loss of the season. He knows full well he's got a team in the Western Conference fully capable of winning 70 games.
Kentucky freshman center Ennis Kanter has been ruled permanently ineligible to play for the Wildcats. The NCAA says that he received more than $30,000 above his, quote, necessary expenses to play for a team in Turkey. Kentucky will apparently appeal that ruling, which seems to me pointless, no?
No, well, it's John Calipari, so anything he does regarding getting players should be put under a neutron microscope. This guy got a salary, okay?
Yeah.
You can't recruit guys with salaries.
The 2011 NHL All-Star Game will apparently follow a new format, and I love this. Players will be chosen by fans, but teams will be created when the two team captains pick their teammates schoolyard fashion on live TV. You think the last guy picked is going to sit at the end of the bench and pout?
Well, how would you like to be Sidney Crosby and decide that, for example, you don't want to pick Evgeny Malkin. You want to pick, Blake Wheeler from the Bruins or somebody. And by the way, can you do that thing with a hockey stick that we used to do with baseball bats?
Oh, yeah, with the fist over
your hand on top of each other?
Yeah, yeah. I like that.
Except you know what happens at the end? The guy who loses hits you in the face with the blade.
Exactly. We may also see a record set for biggest guy who's ever been standing on his toes saying, pick me, pick me, pick me. And finally, Charlie, under what circumstances would two constables in Western Pennsylvania, where we're into constable territory, under what circumstances would said constables in Western Pennsylvania be able to serve warrants by just driving up to the homes of folks they're looking for, honking the horn, and waiting for the miscreants to come out?
Well, there are two circumstances, actually. One is that it's really 1695 and we're in Nottingham, and I think we can sort of reject that. Or number two, that when they doll themselves up in a Pittsburgh Steelers van.
That's it.
And people think there's a Pittsburgh Steeler in the van come to see them.
In their
driveway. What's really going to be great is if they have to serve a warrant at a campus bar, everybody's going to think it's Roethlisberger.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
In May of 2009, the citizens of Allen, Texas, voted to build a $60 million high school football stadium. The news made very few headlines until nearly a year later, when the story spread on the internet as another example of Friday Night Lights gone wrong. But is it? Only a Game's Karen Given recently visited Allen and returned with this report.
Let's get one thing straight. The city of Allen, Texas, population 85,315, did not pass a $60 million bond to build a new high school football stadium. The city of Allen, Texas, passed a $120 million bond to build a new high school football stadium, fine arts auditorium, and career tech center. The parents of Allen, Texas, and there are a lot of parents in Allen, Texas, want you to know that they want the best for their kids, not just for the kids who play football. Some of those parents have gathered on a balcony in Allen High School's Grand Hall to watch the marching band lead the way to the Friday morning pep rally. The Grand Hall is wide enough to fit four tuba players marching abreast, which is necessary because the Allen High School band has 16 tuba players. Near as anyone can figure, this is the largest high school marching band outside of Tokyo, Japan, with 550 members plus the color guard and a dance squad called the Talonettes.
Allen is very different. It is a one of a kind in our state.
Anthony Gibson is the director of fine arts for Allen Independent School District. He's looking forward to next fall when the school will finally have an indoor practice space big enough to fit the entire band. And while football is king in Texas, he says in Allen, the band comes in a very close second. Some might even call them partners.
I think the neatest part is that our kids have developed a very genuine respect for each other. Football players appreciate the band, and the drill team, you know, appreciates the football players, and so there's a unity there that's very unique in Allen.
If you ever attend a pep rally at Allen High School, don't forget your earplugs. In this school of nearly 4,000, each group is louder than the last. First, it's Miss Robenthal's American Sign Language class to lead the school in the national anthem. Then the color guard, the Talonettes, the girls' volleyball players, and finally the captains of the football team, who really do seem to appreciate the band.
Oh my God, it's our last home game. So we need y'all. We need the seniors. We need the juniors. And we most definitely need the band.
We are going to fifth period.
It's hard to imagine a lot of schoolwork gets done in the hour or so after the Friday morning pep rally. But across the street, a different kind of work is going on as construction teams dig deep into the ground at the future site of the 18,000-seat Allen High School Stadium. From his second-floor office, head football coach Tom Westerberg keeps daily tabs on the progress.
This whole side of the building is glass, and so all of our offices look out this direction, so it's fun to watch.
Coach Westerberg has his own office, as do the offensive and defensive coordinators. There are desks for at least a dozen assistants who coach the nearly 1,200 kids who play football in grades 7 through 12. There's a modern weight room, a film room, separate dressing rooms for football, soccer, baseball, and track, and an indoor practice field that's 55 yards long and nearly regulation width. Everything in Allen is a first-class facility, except, of course, for the football stadium. The Eagles currently play in a 7,000-seat stadium built in 1976. Another 7,000 temporary seats are brought in for the season. With families that hoard season tickets for decades and a fast-growing population, Westerberg says the stadium doesn't come close to accommodating everyone.
We did a lottery this year, but before we did a lottery, they were camping outside for a couple of days to get maybe 200 tickets that were available.
Steve Williams is the athletic director for Allen ISD. He says people in Allen are more worried about where their seats will be in the new stadium than they are with how to pay for it. And he says the $60 million facility will be used for a lot more than just football.
We're having a wrestling room in here, and our wrestling program is really big in Allen, defending state champions in wrestling. And our golf team was runner-up, and our girls have won state championships twice. We have an indoor hitting area for the girls' golf team and the boys' golf team. So, you know, it's a multi-purpose facility.
As the town gathers for the last home game of the season, sisters Zena Bender and Deborah Del Reyes arrive early for good seats in the general admissions section. Deborah's daughter is a flute player in the band, and Zena is just a football fan. But neither think it was controversial for their town to spend $60 million on a new stadium.
No. Anything for our kids. We want them to have the best, always.
I know what you're thinking. Allen must be one of those rich towns like Beverly Hills, where homes are worth millions and kids drive Bentleys. Allen is a white-collar community where outlet malls are more common than housing projects. But Zena and Deborah are ordinary moms who live in a city where the median income is $88,000 and the average home price is under $200,000. Long ago, the town of Allen decided to build just one high school, and that's why it serves nearly 4,000 students in grades 10 through 12.
That way you don't have the division like in Plano. They have Plano East and Plano West, and it's a great big rivalry. We want to be one big family. I'll pay the higher taxes for that. Not a problem.
I know. I don't even like football, and I'm here every week. I get excited.
She took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy.
If you've ever watched an episode of Glee and questioned whether American high school students really dress in lavish costumes and enthusiastically sing Journey songs, you can find the answer at the Allen High School Boo Bowl, the last home game before Halloween. Every senior and every member of the band is dressed for the occasion. This is Texas, where cheerleaders lead prayers on the field and the stands are filled with everyone from newborn babies to great-grandparents. Some Allen residents aren't happy to be spending $60 million on a high school football stadium. This is the eighth time in the past 20 years the district has asked voters to approve a bond for capital projects for schools. But Rob Morton, the father of a Talonette, says he's not worried about how much the stadium costs. He's more worried that the new stadium won't be big enough.
There was a vote. We all voted for it. There was no controversy whatsoever. Everybody, it wasn't a close vote. And so I think everyone kind of needs to settle down about that. We're going to build it, and we'll sell it out.
The Allen Eagles haven't lost a game all season, but every time the train horn sounds from the visitors section, it means the Hebron Hawks have scored. Allen ISD Superintendent Ken Helvey can barely take his eyes off the field long enough to give an interview. With a perfect view from right under the press box, Helvey admits that he didn't have to stand in line or enter a lottery to get his seats.
I did not. One of the great advantages of this, hang on just a second. Oh, yeah. One of the great advantages of being the superintendent is I get good seats. And in this stadium, that's pretty tough to get.
Though Helvey's focus is on the field, he says it's not all about the game. Football is also a way to get more students involved with the school. And with a student body of thousands, that's important.
The more students you keep connected to things, the more positive they're going to feel and the more they're going to be performing academically and feeling good about it. So it's a great place to be. Go, John. Go, go, go. There you go, baby. Go.
At halftime, the Talonettes, dressed as Lady Gaga, dance to Lady Gaga. The marching band doesn't do a lot of marching. With almost 600 members, they can't do much more than line up on every five-yard line and fill the entire field. Allen didn't always have thousands of fans packing the stands, but they didn't always have thousands of students in their high school either.
When I graduated from Allen in 64, I had 18 in my graduating class. Population of Allen was 650 people.
Bobby Curtis played football for Allen in the early 60s, before Dallas had sprawled north. The team was good back then, but it's better now. The Eagles went to the state semifinals in 2003 and 2006 and won the state championship in 2008 when 30,000 people drove 4 hours from Allen to Houston to cheer the Eagles on in Reliance Stadium. But when Allen was a small farming community and not the home of shopping centers, everybody still came to the stadium to watch football.
It's a neat place. Allen is a wonderful, neat place. We pretty well still fill the stands and supported the kids, even when they wasn't winning.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabue. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern. We had help this week from John Kalish and from Garmin Productions in Oklahoma City. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen's Allen, Texas photos, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Allen, Texas resident Kurt Cotty, who thinks his town's $60 million football stadium is a relative bargain.
It does seem like a lot of money for a high school stadium, but when you compare it to Jerry World, where the Cowboys play, it seems reasonable to me anyway.
Yes. Well, as in so many things, context is all. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the effectiveness of charitable giving at fjc.org. This is NPR.